Welcome to From the Horse's Mouth, the official podcast of Providence Day School, bringing you spirited, informative, and entertaining conversations from the global PD community. Now here's our host, a familiar face and a voice on the PDS campus, world language teacher Jay Barron.
Well, welcome to From the Horse's Mouth. Thank you for coming in and talking. We get to talk about one of my favorite topics today, which is international travel. And we have a group of PD faculty who have all been beneficiaries of either Global Educator Certificate travel money or faculty Eichenbrenner Award money.
Professional development
money. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And so we're just going to talk about that today. And I want to start with you, Kristen Santo, who got to go to Jordan, I believe.
Did.
With the Global Educator Certificate. And, of course, that is basically a wonderful program. We're so lucky to work at Providence Day where we can get money to follow our passions and go somewhere in the world, correct?
Exactly. That, honestly, this is my fourth year at Providence Day, and it's one of the key reasons why I actually wanted to come and teach here, knowing that the opportunity for professional development and global travel and bringing that back to the classroom is a core component of the school. So I was lucky enough to have my first trip in Jordan, and it was an unbelievable experience.
Before I go around and also talk to Amy Jordan and Richard Dewey who are here, why Jordan?
Well, I was thinking, where in the world have I always wanted to go and might never get a chance to do so? And I think I was interested in Jordan, as I think a lot of probably people my age, when I saw Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom, and that last scene is filmed in Petra. I also grew up watching David Lean classics, and so Lawrence of Arabia had always interested me, and a lot of that is filmed in the Wadi Rum. So, and then I used to teach in England, and one of my coworkers' father is a diplomat and actually lives in Amman. And so twice a year, she would go home to Jordan and would come back with her stories of this amazing country and culture and food and sleeping in a Bedouin tent and floating in the Dead Sea. And that just sounded amazing. And then when I realized they have a round square school there called the King's Academy in Madaba, it was like, oh, I can actually visit a school. Their middle school had just opened only a couple years ago. So I knew as a professional development coordinator and middle school teacher that I could really learn from them and hopefully vice versa and get to experience a place and culture that I might never get to.
Amy, let's go to you and let's hear about a trip that you've taken. You've taken a couple of trips, especially one that is just meaningful in the classroom, just as Kristen was saying, something that maybe you've been able to bring back into the classroom. Tell us about that.
I went on a trip to Kyrgyzstan where I tracked snow leopards and their prey up in the Chin Shen Mountains. And that was a good trip for me because I'm a molecular biologist, a bench scientist, and many of my students are interested in environmental issues. And as important as they are now, being able to give them a sort of taste of what outdoor research can be like was important to me.
Because you were a researcher first before you were in the classroom, correct?
Yes, yes.
Right, and so that connection. Fantastic. And snow leopards in the
Chin Chin Mountains.
Sorry, a sentence no one's ever said to me before.
It was a nice challenge. That's partly why I wanted to go. I like cats. I'm a middle-aged school marm with cats. So the snow leopard was way too tempting not to go see. And, you know, we had a base camp that was very primitive at 10,000 feet. You know, no electricity or water or anything like that. And, you know, we had to hike up to 18,000 feet, which was a physical challenge. So the kids love to hear that. They like to know that, well, their teachers are doing that kind of thing. It makes them a lot more excited and just it makes them more likely to listen. And also, I've had students ask me how I did it. And some of them, one in particular right now, is preparing to make a trip. It'll be a little bit less maybe primitive. When she's older, she'll have the opportunity to make a choice to, you know, do something a little more dangerous or risky. But I think that there'll be more students doing this kind of trip because I have another similar trip I'll also be presenting to the school soon. So I think, you know, students will take advantage of this.
It's so exciting to think about how this can impact kids and what ideas it might give them for ways they want to explore the world. But let's hear a little bit from you, Richard, before we talk about the classroom connection. Talk to me about Japan.
Yes, Japan. I've always been interested in Japan, and specifically in Kyoto. At different times in my life, Kyoto popped up as the locale of something that I was interested in or something I was studying. So I crafted for my grant, a trip that was entirely in Kyoto. So I tell people I went to Japan, but in fact, all my time was spent in Kyoto. Just a fabulous city. And it's really today the city in Japan that has best preserved traditional Japanese culture. So if you want to see what is left of traditional Japanese culture, that's the city to go to in Japan.
You were telling me recently about one of the observations that you made, one of the cultural observations you made about taxi drivers.
Well, yes. This is my first trip. I've traveled a fair amount, but always in the West. And this is my first trip to Asia. And it was just fascinating, the differences. And I found the Japanese people to be just so wonderful. And I understand I'm a tourist, and a lot of the people that I was encountering were
sure.
people in the tourist industry.
Right.
But everyone I met, they were all just wonderful, very friendly, and very, I would use the word grateful. That was my sense of it. So you go to take a taxi. One thing, the taxis are pretty amazing. The doors open on their own. You don't, when you want to get in the taxi, you don't pull to open the door. They press a button, the door opens for you, and you sit in. And the taxi drivers all wear white gloves,
mm-hmm.
and there's a little tray in the middle where you pay when your ride is finished. You pay your money, and they'll either hand you change or hand you your credit card back with both hands. It's just, and everyone is like that. It's just so different from what I'm used to in the States or in some of these other countries I've visited.
Well, and I know that you also told me that when you travel, you do like to go in with an open mind and just
yes.
Try not to impose your assumptions about what it's like in that country on the experience you're actually having in that country.
Correct, yeah. And I think I mentioned that I know there are bad people in Japan, and that there are prisons in Japan, and some people break the law. But it's just, I was just astounded by just how nice, how friendly, how polite, how humble everyone I met was.
I've had the chance to travel thoroughly in Mexico and also in Spain and some in South America, and I'm always surprised also by some of those little things, which is one reason why I like the white glove story, just because, okay, this is something that is truly different, and it's worth noticing. I'm curious to know about some of the details that you observed on your trips as well. Amy, do you have anything that jumps out?
A taxi story also.
Oh, why?
So in Kyrgyzstan, they don't have taxis. It's people in their car who are taxi drivers. So you really can't identify necessarily who they are.
Well, that's Uber, right?
Well, no. It's random. So I spent about 2 years learning a bit of Russian before I went. But I would get in a taxi, and both of us would list five languages we could roughly speak, and none of them would cross over, except for the Russian, you know. And so then we'd speak Russian. The people speak Kyrgyz, which I did not learn. But then there was a time when I was coming, you know, there's a lot of poverty there. And people were ready to relieve me of my money by, you know, any way they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't always nice. So, mm-hmm. you know, you had to be kind of careful there, being female, being alone in the city. And yeah, I just kind of had to keep my eyes open, but I needed to get back to my hotel. And of course, I can't tell who's a taxi driver and who's not. So all these guys started this bidding war for who was going to drive me back to the hotel. And I finally chose the person who owned the shop I was in, because his whole family was there working. And they made him a little paper hat, like for a taxi driver, and put it on his head, and they thought it was very cute. So I was like, this guy is probably all right. And so he gave me his phone number, and then he was my taxi driver the rest of the time I was there. I could just call him and get a ride. So another taxi story.
Do you have any taxi stories, Kristen?
I did take taxis, but Amman is very modernized, so I took an Uber, and so I didn't have a taxi story. Mine is, I guess, kind of a cultural awareness story where I've been, like you, fortunate to do some traveling, especially through Europe and Southern Africa. But when I planned the trip, I used an organization called GEO, and it's mostly catered for educators to travel, but then to stay for a few extra days to visit, do my school visits, because I actually visited two schools. So when my tour ended Saturday night, and I arranged my school visits for Monday and Tuesday. So I'm in Amman by myself walking around on Sunday, and I'm looking and like, wow, there's a lot of children in school uniforms in the middle of the day. And it only dawned on me, sadly, late, that their school week, their business week, their work week is Sunday to Thursday. And it was just kind of this aha moment of how westernized and kind of the Christian, Judeo-Christian or just Christian mentality that I'd had, that it never dawned on me that their weekdays, their school days. And so the schools I visited were up and running on Sunday, and I could easily have gone Sunday and Monday and stay, you know, spared a day. But it ended up being a great kind of story to tell my students too, of just the assumptions we make all the time. And talking also to our tour guide, I'd, you know, read all the guidebooks and about length of pants and shorts and wearing, though I knew I didn't have to wear a headscarf, but covering any chest area, shoulders. And, you know, our tour guide, in a way, for some of that, kind of laughed and said, that's a little extreme, you know. And so I felt a better awareness of just the cultural assumptions we make. So I feel like that's kind of one of the most important things I could bring back to my students.
We do want to stay on the safe side.
Right. Yeah. So I did dress very conservatively over there, which I, you know, try to tend to do anyway. But anyway, that was kind of my
aha
moment.
And now they all assume that all Americans are very formal.
Yes, of course.
And don't understand that there's school outside.
Completely.
So let's bring it back to the classroom. Tell me about some of those specific moments that you had, or maybe just some of the takeaways you had from your trip that you've really been able to connect with the kids on. Amy, how about you start us off this time?
Well, there's a couple of things, and I think the biggest thing is that science is often messy. They think of experiments where they'll get a definite answer. Maybe in the lab they mixed acids and bases and they got a pH, right? And that was perfect. But experiments aren't that neat. Science isn't neat. Medicine is not neat. We're all very different. A controlled experiment doesn't always work on people. But then when you get in the environment, it's kind of crazy out there. There's a lot of things impacting any research you do, and your data is very
fuzzy.
Like
being at 18,000 feet, for example.
Yeah, and you can't breathe, so you might not be thinking clearly. Who knows what you're going to write in your lab book?
Right.
But helping them deal with understanding, like, data collection and being able to understand charts and graphs and know how to interpret those and try not to be led astray and help them understand the use of statistics and why some of these signals are so fuzzy. There's a lot of big environmental issues facing us, and, you know, it can be hard to make sense of them. And so we talk about how it's hard to make sense, how you collect data, why you need citizen scientists out there collecting data, because you need such a broad amount of data to draw any kind of conclusion. But also, mountains are a great place to study things like global warming, where the increase in altitude changes the type of ecosystem very quickly as you go up. And so you can see signals like that. You can see an ecosystem change quickly where they are clearly delineated by altitude. And so I teach them some of that too.
What would you say the single element, or maybe the main elements from your trip that have really intrigued the kids most have been?
They think it's cool. They think snow leopards are cool. They think going to 18,000 feet is cool. They think living in a field and being fed by nomads is cool. They think learning Russian to go on a trip and hoping you can speak it enough to understand because you have to is cool. So that sense of wonder is, and knowing is great. You need to have some knowledge, but you'll never be motivated to get it and truly understand it unless you're very inspired. And so it's really just the coolness that catches their attention. After that, they'll listen to just about anything I say.
Richard, did you pick up some Japanese? Did you learn or Russian?
Wish.
Which did
I
you
wish,
study?
You know, it's funny because I speak a fair amount of Spanish, and in many countries I visit, I can get by with either English or Spanish. But Japanese, we landed and realized very quickly that, whoa, we're kind of on our own, you know? It's because not that many Japanese speak English. compared to Western countries, their knowledge of English is pretty minimal. So that's a little bit tough.
Absolutely. Yeah. So connect Kyoto to art classes.
Well, there were a few things I was really interested in exploring. One was Shodo, which is Japanese calligraphy. I took a Shodo class. I was also interested in Sumi-e, which is Japanese ink wash painting. When we got there, I was talking to the people at the hotel, and they said, and I asked, hey, you couldn't find any Sumi-e teachers? And they said, well, we found some, but we couldn't find any who spoke English. So, and I was a little disappointed, because in terms of what I bring back to Providence Day, I was thinking, well, Japanese calligraphy, I'm not going to have my students do paint Japanese calligraphy. It doesn't make any sense, you know, and I could hardly do it. The symbols don't have meaning to me.
Right.
What meaning are they going to have to my students? But what I discovered actually is there are a lot of similarities in terms of technical skill between Shodo and Sumi-e. In both cases, you're using the Japanese brushes. But from the Shodo class and also from doing some research, in fact, throughout some other traditional Japanese arts and crafts, what I discovered is a lot of it is related to Zen Buddhism, which is a Japanese form of Buddhism. And it's all about being in the present. Zen Buddhism became popular in Japan during the time of the samurai. And for the samurai, life could be short. You didn't know if today was your last day. So for them, Zen was very appealing because it was all about living in the present and also connecting your mind and body, having your mind and body work together. And what I discovered from the Japanese calligraphy class that I took is that it's all about focusing on your action at the moment. And I should say, with Japanese calligraphy, you make a line and then you move on. You don't try to correct your line. You don't go back. And I think that's very hard for many people. Whether it's perfect or not, it is what it is, right?
I can see how that would inform an art class.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right?
And I learned some techniques that I have not tried on my students yet, but I'm doing more research on that to develop more techniques, just in terms of having better control of your brush and having that direct mind-body connection where you're totally focused on what you're doing. Often, you know, art classes tend to be fairly informal. Kids can be talking during class, which is absolutely fine. But one could make the argument that if you're talking, you're not totally focused on the action of moving your brush, right? So it's a very different mindset. And what I'm hoping to do as the year progresses is develop more, and these are meant to be just short exercises, maybe warm-ups, that get them for short periods of time to focus on that. And it could be doing straight lines. I wish I had a brush to demonstrate, but doing straight lines, but more pressure, less pressure, more pressure, less pressure, and you end up making a wave, even though it's a straight line. There are a lot of interesting little things like that.
And so if you are Providence Day and you're listening, if you sign up for art, you'll be studying with the Zen master. Thank you very much.
Hardly.
Let me ask you, Kristen, a slightly different version, because I really want to hear how you've connected with the classroom. But also, you know what? I can Google Petra. I can see pictures online. What? Do we really have to have our faculty go to these places?
You know, I think, yes.
Glad you said that.
I know.
Correct answer.
Of course. I think our experience inform who we are, you know.
Absolutely.
And as a middle school teacher, it's honestly our content is second by far in middle school. If you ask a lot of middle school teachers, they say, oh, I teach middle school. Oh, I teach English or I teach history. You know, that's who we are. And the kids are looking to us to see, okay, what is it like to be an adult? And so I think by actually experiencing and going places and seeing it, I think that's what's inspiring. And how have I been able to directly connect Jordan to my seventh grade English class? It's not super direct, but it has changed me. And I think when the kids hear about my adventure, they always ask, did I ride a camel? And did I float in the Dead Sea? And can
learn
you actually
how to use a whip?
Yes, can you actually go into the treasury at, you know, in Petra and to see something that is over 3,000 years old and it looks untouched and created without modern tools? It is just unbelievable. And for the kids to be able to, my kids to be able to see those pictures and see, but also see me as a human being. There's a picture of me on, that my friend that I made on the trip took of us, you know, in the middle of the Wadi Rum desert, wind everywhere, you know, just my, just pure joy being on that camel, even though it's amazingly uncomfortable. But it, it was one of the, one of my favorite memories. And so I think that's more what I bring back. And I remember a student telling me that I taught in seventh grade and got in touch with me recently and just said, you know, you're the reason why I've traveled. You're hearing your stories of working and living and traveling abroad has opened, have opened my eyes to a bigger world out there that I had never even considered. And so for me, I think going to a place in the Middle East, especially a place, you know, a area of the world I had never been to, an area of the world that is very, I believe, misunderstood, and I think for people to hear about my adventure there and to come back and to talk about the unbelievable generosity of the Jordanian people is probably the most important thing I can do.
I'm quite sure that all three of you have inspired and will inspire people to travel, and I really appreciate you talking about it today. I wish we had some more time, but thanks for coming in and sharing your stories.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us today to hear it all straight from the horse's mouth, our spirited official school podcast. Be sure to join us again to hear the voices of our global PD community in future episodes. You can find episodes and more information at providenceday.org/podcast.